Hello, lovelies. My name is Caitlin, and welcome to another episode of True Crime with Caitlin. Today, we're going to be talking about a man who is considered to be Wales's worst serial killer, who was dubbed the Man in Black. This is the case of Peter Moore. Ernest and Edith Moore had been married for so long that they knew each other inside out, and not a lot came to them as a surprise. However, right at the start of 1946, Ernest got one of the biggest shocks in his life when Edith revealed that she was pregnant. The couple had sort of came to terms that parenthood wasn't something they would be blessed with. Edith was in her 40s and under the impression that she was infertile, so this pregnancy came as a huge shock, but she was elated. On the 19th of September 1946, Edith would give birth to a baby boy named Peter Howard Moore, and she described him as her miracle baby. As he grew older, Peter would give Edith her own pet name, calling her Chummy instead of Mummy. He had a much closer bond with his mum than he did his dad. Peter was very much buttered up and wrapped up in cotton wool by Edith. He was her world, he could do no wrong in her eyes, and she just adored and showered him in affection. Ernest, however, was quite different. He would be described by Peter as overpowering, dominating, aggressive, sometimes violent, and that he always had to be in control. The family moved from St Helens, Merseyside to Kimnal Bay on the northern coast of Wales when Peter was 6 years old. They moved into Darlington House, which was a big building on St Asaph Avenue. The front of the building was a hardware shop, which Ernest ran and worked from, then the family would live out the back. The Moores lived a very comfortable life. They were relatively well off financially, meaning that Peter had the opportunity to do a lot of fun things, including going to the cinema, which he fell in love with. He loved the over-the-topness, the glitz, the glamour, movies such as Moulin Rouge being all the rage at the time. Peter was one of the very few people in that area of Wales that owned a cine camera, so he would either be seen behind the camera, taking family videos and making memories, or in front of it, smiling away. As he got older, he would help his dad out in the front of the shop, and the customers loved him. He would go out his way to help wherever he could, whether that was helping to pick out exactly what the customer needed to buy or making deliveries without a charge. He was very well liked by all the regulars in the shop. He would be described as always smiling, polite, very respectful, addressing the customers as Mr. or Mrs., whatever the names were, and some would say that he was feminine, which to them meant that he was weird, and apparently he was very camp. It was supposedly quite obvious to a lot of people that Peter was gay, however he kept this shielded from his parents. Being gay in that time was still very sadly taboo and not something that was hugely accepted, never mind celebrated. Peter kept his sexuality hidden from Edith because he didn't want to upset her, and from Ernest so that it didn't anger him. Ernest Moore would pass away in 1979, and with his father's passing, Peter felt a new sense of freedom. He was no longer under his father's control or his watchful eye. Peter took over running the hardware shop, but now with this new freedom, he decided to have a go at his lifelong ambition, doing something that he was so passionate about, and he began reopening cinemas, which took him all over North Wales. He would refurbish and reopen, I think, 5 small cinemas, including ones in Kimnal Bay, Holyhead, Denby, and Bagilt. I'm sorry if I pronounced that wrong. He was met with a lot of praise following the reopening and refurbishments. He would be featured in several newspapers and on the news where he gave interviews. Here is a news broadcast from back then, which was featured in the documentary Darkland, Hunt for Wales's Worst Serial Killer.
A man from North Wales is achieving a lifetime ambition of owning his own cinema. Peter Moore from Kinwell Bay has managed to buy 5 screens in as many years.
And as a child, I went to a cinema in St Helens on Merseyside, where we used to live, and was immediately captivated by the glamour and the glitz and everything. And I decided there and then that I would like to own a cinema.
After the death of Edith in 1994, there was a noticeable difference in Peter. He would now frequent all of the hotspots where gay men would go to meet other gay men for relations or one-night stands, and he wasn't discreet with his interest in S&M and bondage. He was almost always completely kitted out in black leather, which is part of the reason he would later be dubbed the Man in Black. On his 49th birthday in 1995, while in Rhyl, he would walk into a combat shop and purchase a knife, and this would be the beginning of Peter Moore's reign of terror. In late September, Peter was driving back to Kimnell Bay from Holyhead when he noticed a man on the side of the road, a man he had seen several times before while making this journey that he made often. This was 56-year-old Henry Roberts. Henry was a retired railway worker who was a bit of a recluse. He lived alone with his pet Labrador and mostly kept himself to himself. I believe most of his social interactions came from his daily visits to his local pub, the Sportsman Arms. Henry and Peter had actually crossed paths before, only a few days prior. Peter had pretended that his van had broken down either on or near Henry's drive, which was in an unfrequented area. Henry came out of the house to see what was going on, to see if he could help, and he and Peter stood chatting for a short time, and through this they found that they had a mutual interest, which was that they were both fans of Nazis and that Henry had an extensive Nazi memorabilia collection. So on this day in late September, Peter is driving along when he notices Henry walking towards his house. Peter continues to drive on, passing Henry, but he is no longer on his way to Kimnell Bay. He parks his van a short distance away from Henry's home and then waits. After being sat for however long, Peter retrieved a knife and made his way over to Henry's house, and once he was there, he started making some sort of racket which lured Henry outside. Peter would later say that they had a discussion before he withdrew the knife and began to stab Henry in a frenzy. In shock, horror, and confusion, Henry spun on his heels and tried to bolt away from Peter back into the safety of his home, but Peter pursued him. There was never really much distance put between the two men. So as Henry is trying to escape, running away from Peter, Peter is directly behind him, repeatedly stabbing him in the back. Henry would end up either falling over some steps or collapsing, losing all of his energy to continue to fight for his life. As he lay on the ground, either dead or dying, Peter pulled down Henry's trousers right to the ankles and inflicted 2 stab wounds on each of his buttocks. Peter then went inside of Henry's house and began rummaging around, and he would end up stealing at least one thing, which was a swastika flag. On the 27th of September, a couple of the regulars inside of the Sportsman Arms noticed that they hadn't seen Henry in a few days. The first day or two, they didn't really think much of it. Henry would go every single day, but missing a day or two wasn't something that was going to raise alarm bells. Maybe he's poorly or unwell, or maybe he's just out of town. However, after it had been a couple of days, some of the men began growing concerned, including a man named Thomas Wright, who offered to go over to Henry's house just to check up on him. When he arrived, he would find the body of Henry lay motionless, face down on the ground, and it was clear that something was wrong. Thomas quickly contacted North Wales Police, who promptly arrived. Their very first impression was somehow they thought that Henry could have fallen off of the roof. I don't know if it's just because of how his body was lay, or if there was something at the scene that indicated that. You know, if there was ladders leading up to the roof, or slats that had fallen off the roof were scattered around Henry. I don't know where that impression came from, especially because, like I say, his pants were all the way down and there was probably a lot of blood surrounding him. However, when they approached Henry to check for any signs of life, there was none, and it was crystal clear that he had been the victim of a vicious assault. During his autopsy, it was found that Henry was covered in stab wounds, some of them being as deep as 5 inches. He had 13 wounds to his back, right from the top, almost at his neck, all the way down to his bum. He had a wound on each of his buttocks. He had 14 more wounds on the front of his body, going all the way from his shoulder to his pubic bone. Along with all of these wounds, there was evidence that Henry had tried as hard as he could to fight for his life against his attacker. An examination would also show that there was no signs of sexual assault. It was determined that Henry likely died between the 22nd and the 25th of September, so he could have potentially been laid dead in his own yard for up to 5 days before anyone noticed. Investigators did a sweep of his house for any evidence or even at a hint of a motive. They kind of ruled out robbery because it didn't appear like anything was stolen, but then it's not like anyone else lived with Henry that could point out if anything was missing. A quick side note I just want to add in here is that later, Peter would try and almost justify Henry's murder and the murders that followed because he was going through financial stress and he was still grieving the loss of his mother. He tried to paint the murders almost like a stress relief for him, so when he pretended that his van had broken down on or near Henry's drive prior to the murder, I wonder if that was him purposely scoping out Henry as someone he could attack, or if it was just a crime of opportunity and Henry was sadly spotted at the wrong time. Let me know what you think. Just over a month later, Peter Moore is driving down the old A5 near Mona Anglesey when he pulls up to a roadworks construction site, eyeing up a caravan with a light on. Inside the caravan was 49-year-old Keith Randalls. Keith was a father of two from Chester who was working as an overnight watchman slash security on the site. He lived in the caravan temporarily because the work commute didn't make it worth it for him and he was doing a friend a favour. By all accounts, Keith was a good man, described as kind, loving, affectionate, someone who would do anything for anyone. On the day of the 29th of November 1995, Keith had been in a town where he had a couple of beers before picking up some fish and chips and heading back to the caravan at around 9:30 p.m. Sometime after, there was an unexpected knock on the door. Keith opened the door and before he even had time to register, the man in black stood before him. He was ferociously stabbed in the stomach, causing him to fall out of the caravan. Keith fought against Peter as much as he could, pleading for his life, but this had no effect on him. If anything, it hyped Peter up even more. Keith asked Peter why was he doing this, to which he coldly replied, quote, for fun. Keith would sustain a total of 12 stab wounds all across his chest, back, face, and he had what was described as a huge slicing wound in his armpit. The following morning, men who were clocking into work bright and early would find the body of Keith Randalls, and at around 7:30 a.m, the police were called. When they arrived, they would look inside of the caravan, which appeared to be in disarray. Either a struggle had happened in here, or someone had been rummaging around in there. Knowing what we do now, it was likely the latter. There was also smeared blood found on the door of the caravan. Potentially that got there as Keith had fell out of the caravan and Keith was found with his pants down, just like Henry had been. Despite these similarities, both murders being knife attacks, both victims being lone males in quiet areas, both being found with their pants pulled down, and the attacks happening only 5 miles away from each other, the two cases weren't connected. How is beyond me, so a separate team was set up to investigate Keith's murder. Fingertip searches ensued around the proximity of the caravan and of the construction site, but nothing of value was found. Again, there was no obvious motive, nor signs of robbery, nor signs of sexual assault, and no one close to Keith had any idea why someone would want to barbarically murder him. Fear ripped through North Wales following the second murder. This is something that had never really happened in this area of Wales before, and the communities were terrified, especially because police weren't tying these two murders together. I don't know which is scarier, a double murderer or two murderers being on the loose. People began taking extra precautions. They would travel in pairs or in groups, and late night workers would use taxis to get home, fearing being out in the dark. On the 18th of December, police received a call from a concerned family. 40-year-old Anthony Davies, who just went by Tony, hadn't returned home. He had left the family home he shared with his wife Sheila and their two children around 11 p.m. on the 17th to go and visit his Auntie Anne in Abergele, who had recently had a fall and broken her foot. Anne told the police that yes, Tony had came to visit her and check up on her, but that he had left at around 12:30 a.m. This is Police Constable Phil Greaves in the Darkland, Hunt for Wales' Worst Serial Killer documentary, describing clocking into work on the 18th and beginning a search for Tony.
So Phil, you were on duty on the morning of the 18th of December.
I was, yes. I came in on 6:15 in the morning. The night shift came in and they said, we're looking for a guy who's missing in a red car. So I drove all around the town. I came down Dundonald Avenue over this railway bridge here, and I saw the red car parked against the seawall. I radioed in and said, I found the vehicle. I jumped on the wall, looked down the beach, and saw this body of a man with his head just against the low ebbing tide and his feet up the beach. And he looked like he's
maybe drowned or something. Or
Yeah.
Phil then ran down to Tony's body, scooping his legs up under his arms and began dragging him back up the beach away from the water. This is when Phil noticed the white Aran jumper Tony was wearing had shades of crimson on the front, and as he was pulling him up the beach, his jumper was sort of riding up, and this revealed stab wounds. During Tony's post-mortem, it would be found that he received stab wounds which were described as slits around his abdomen, chest and pubic bone, and that they likely came from a double-edged weapon. He had extensive self-defense wounds showing that he had put up a really good fight against his killer. Back at the beach, investigators would find some vital evidence. Pebbles that were found near Tony's body had blood on them, and so they were taken in as evidence. Analysis would later find two DNA profiles from the bloody pebbles, one being a match to Tony, and one which had to have belonged to his killer. While later talking about Tony's murder, Peter would say that it wasn't planned. He had been stressed out and so went out for a drive in his van when he ended up at Pensarn Beach, which was a known hotspot for men to meet up, and he just so happened upon Tony, who was sat in his red car. He described watching Tony and the start of the attack, saying, quote, "This fellow came in a car, got out and went to the water's edge. I walked round and looked at him, then took the knife out and stabbed him." He would continue on, saying how Tony had really, really put up a fight, and at one point had even managed to overpower Peter and managed to cut him, and that is how his blood ended up on some of the pebbles. But as we know, Peter would end up murdering Tony. After Tony's death, it was said that police could no longer ignore that these murders were, quote, gay-related crimes, and I'm just going to intercept here because there is a huge misconception that Peter Moore murdered only gay men when that isn't true. Henry was a gay man, but there was no proof that either Keith or Tony were gay men, despite it being reported that they were, and Tony's family especially have continuously refuted the claims. Yes, Tony was found on Pensarn Beach, which, like I said, was a hotspot for men to meet up, but it was only 5 minutes away from his Auntie Anne's house, so he could have just wanted a bit of fresh air, and that's why he went there. So police would reach out to the gay community asking for help, which was a huge step, as then the police weren't really someone who the gay community felt like they could trust. Allegedly, police were almost always unbothered when it came to either physical or sexual violence towards gay men, and they would victim blame, essentially saying that these men were bringing it on themselves for being promiscuous. This would make people more reluctant to come forward, and if they did, they could be met with homophobia, which can be traumatic. So with all of this, you can imagine why the gay community and the police didn't have a great, trustworthy relationship. I'm also not saying that every single officer on the force was like this, however, this is how reporting around that exact time period described it. Police knew that people were less likely to come forward and make statements because of the risk of homophobia or even the risk of outing themselves, so they decided to set up an anonymous hotline and urged people to call if they knew anything, if they saw anything suspicious, or if they knew anyone who was acting suspicious. They had many calls come through, however, it would be a call from a man reporting an assault that would lead police down the right path. This anonymous man called the hotline and told police that he had been on Pensarn Beach looking for a partner when he was approached by a man head to toe in black leather, wearing a leather jacket, leather trousers, long boots, and even a leather hat. He jumped into a van with this man to go back to his house to engage in relations and was drove to a place in Kimnal Bay. Once inside the house, he was attacked and beaten so badly that he was lucky to have escaped with his life. Now, this man didn't know the address of the house, but he was able to give police rough but very good directions, which they went out and followed, eventually leading them to Darlington House, Peter Moore's home. A detective that was out on this drive recognised Darlington House because it was the hardware shop, and by now it felt like one of those shops that had been there forever. He knew Peter Moore because Peter had made a couple of reports over the years back when this detective was an officer. He would make reports for shoplifters and people breaking into the hardware store. But this detective knew that Peter was a gay man who was partial to dressing in black leather, and seemingly just like that, the pieces began to fit. Another part of the team were working on trying to identify a van that had been spotted at the beach several times, which was usually being driven by an aggressive man. The van was a rented one, so it had like illustrations or stickers on the side which were very distinct, so police quickly managed to track down exactly where the van was hired from. The company were able to provide police with the name of the man who had hired the van, and of course that was Peter Moore. Police began to build their case against Peter, and everything was fitting. He lived in Kimnal Bay, which isn't even 15 minutes away from Pensarn Beach, where Tony Davies was murdered. He had cinemas all across North Wales, which meant that he would regularly use the A5, which is where the construction site where Keith Randalls was murdered was, and that was only 5 miles away from where Henry Roberts lived, where he was murdered. One of the locations that he travelled to for his cinema work was also where the van hire company was based. He had picked up that man who had called the hotline from Pensarn Beach and attacked him. He fit the description that was given by the man, and the van also fit the description of a van regularly seen at the beach. And of course, this man gave directions that led police almost directly to Darlington House. Police acted swiftly. They needed to get Peter Moore into custody before he could strike again and take another innocent life. On the 22nd of December 1995, two teams from North Wales Police descended on Darlington House ready to arrest Peter. But when they arrived, he wasn't home. He was actually climbing into his van on his way out, so they just started following him. He drove for around 8 minutes before pulling over on Peel Street and just sitting. I think he must have noticed that he was being followed and that the jig was up. An officer approached the van, opened the door, pulled the keys out of the ignition, and asked Peter to step out of the vehicle, arresting him on suspicion of murder. He didn't resist arrest, he didn't proclaim innocence, he'd just done nothing. No reaction or emotions or questions, just silence. This carried on through the 20-minute journey back to the station. He didn't make a peep in the back of the police car. When the van he was in was later searched, they found a black Haldol bag on the passenger seat, and inside, there was a knife. Peter Moore may have been on his way out, prowling for another victim. For almost 2 days straight, Peter denied any involvement whatsoever. He tried to provide phony alibis and would not take accountability or confess. However, in the early hours of Christmas Eve, he told police, with his solicitor sat beside him, quote, "I want to admit to both of the murders in Anglesey, the murder on Pensarn Beach, and I want to admit to another murder that you don't even know about." Edward Patrick Carthy was 13 years old when his mum passed away and he was taken in by his beloved older sister Lynn to live with her, her husband and her kids. Lynn would say that from then on, quote, "He weren't my brother, he was my son." Lynn would describe Edward, who just went by Ted, as very clever, that he always had his nose in a book, and this reflected academically. Ted would go on to get all his A-levels. In October 1995, Ted Carthy was having a night out on the town with his friends in Liverpool when they ended up in Paco's on Stanley Street, which was a gay bar, where he would sadly cross paths with Peter Moore, who was also inside of the bar. Peter approached an incredibly intoxicated Ted and offered to give him a lift home, which he accepted. Once inside the van and driving, Ted dozed off to sleep, and according to Peter, it was in this moment that he decided what he was going to do. Instead of taking him back to his home, Peter began driving towards North Wales. Ted eventually awoke, startled and alarmed because he didn't recognise his surroundings. He was no longer in Liverpool. In a panic, he tried pulling at the door, but Peter had locked it, trapping him inside of the van. It took around an hour and a half for Peter to drive from Paco's Bar to Clockenog Woods. He demanded Ted to get out of the van, and when he refused, probably terrified, Peter dragged him out. He would describe pulling out his knife and it gleaming in the moonlight. Ted looked at Peter, probably not even believing what he's saying, maybe even thinking that this was some sort of sick joke, and asked him, quote, "Are you one of these Nielsen types?" To which Peter replied with a straight, serious face, "Yes," before plunging the knife into Ted's stomach. Ted was referring to notorious Scottish serial killer Dennis Nielsen, who had murdered up to 15 boys and young men by the time he was captured in 1983. Ted would be stabbed by Peter at least 3 times in the abdomen, and after he died, Peter dragged his body further into Clockenog Woods, where he hid him under a tree. After relaying this onto police, Peter then drew them a map showing them where he had left Ted, and they got to searching. Because Ted had been out there in the wilderness for weeks at this point, when his body was found, it was in a skeletal state and wildlife had interfered with it, resulting in his head being removed. Teeth taken from the skull would confirm that the skeleton found inside of Clockenog Woods was 28-year-old Edward Carthy. Because Ted had been murdered in October, this made him the second victim of Peter Moore. Since his disappearance, Lynn had been down at the police station almost daily trying to report Ted missing, and it wasn't until her wedding anniversary, December 29th, that she was told that her beloved brother, who she had raised like a son, was dead. Throughout his many interviews, Peter would coldly detail each of the murders, even noting that he believed he had, quote, "done a job well done." He would also confess to around 50 physical and sexual assaults which had happened over the course of the last 20 years. For 20 years, Peter Moore had been physically and sexually assaulting people, and because of the stigma around being gay and the lack of confidence men had in police, they weren't coming forward to report it. He would partially describe what he would do, saying, quote, "When driving around, I would sometimes notice someone walking along the road late at night and I would stop and attack them. I would assault them with a police truncheon and strike them on the body and their heads many times. Usually, I would be dressed as a policeman or in a Nazi uniform or something similar, just to scare them. I heard that a few of these men had been seriously injured after the attacks. A search of Darlington House would reveal harrowing evidence. As I mentioned before, Peter was very much into S&M and bondage. He was a sexual sadist, which, when that is all mutually consensual, then fine. But he would have whips that were like dripping with blood, where he had struck someone with so much force. There was blood splattered on some of the walls from the whippings, which of course was really alarming to see. This sort of told investigators that Peter enjoyed seeing people in extreme distress and or in pain, and that he wanted all of the control. Throughout the house, investigators were able to find items that tied to each of the victims. They found a swastika flag matching the one Peter described stealing from Henry. They found a camcorder that was missing from Keith's caravan. A damp jacket that was hung up on a coat hanger in a hallway was confirmed to have belonged to Tony Davies. Inside of a pond on the property, more personal items were retrieved, including some belonging to Ted Carthy, such as keys, wallets, phones, and watches. Inside of the pond, there was also a knife that had been wrapped up in a plastic bag, which when forensically examined, showed traces of all four of the victims' blood. An extremely blood-stained jacket found inside Peter's homes, which was also forensically examined, again showed traces of all of the victims' blood. Darlington House was described as being littered with stuff such as whips, handcuffs, other bondage accessories, a collection of knives, baseball bats, a truncheon with a police officer's uniform, German military hats, and much more. But the only room of the house which was completely clear of this type of stuff was the room which had once belonged to Edith, Peter's mother. This room was kept in such pristine condition that it was described as a shrine to his mother. Peter Muir was officially charged with quadruple murder and was remanded at Walton in Liverpool. This just means that he was in jail up until his trial, that he wasn't going to get bailed. A couple of days into this, Peter completely recanted his whole entire confession and now tried to pin the blame onto an imaginary friend named Jason and said that he was just an innocent bystander in it all. Of course, the evidence against Peter was damning, and this was just him trying to either worm his way out of it or trying to feign a mental illness. It would come out in court that the imaginary friend Jason was actually Jason Voorhees from the Friday the 13th films. Peter's trial began at Mauld Crown Court in Flintshire, Wales in November 1996, where he admitted, quote, "I don't feel any remorse whatsoever for what I've done." The prosecution introduced Peter, saying, quote, "Black was his uniform. He was the man in black, with black clothes, black thoughts, and the blackest of deeds." The trial lasted for 4 weeks, and after a short 35 minutes of deliberation, the jury found Peter Muir guilty on all four counts of murder. He would go on to be sentenced to a whole life order, meaning that he will spend the rest of his natural life behind bars. He will never be released. From what I could find, as of 2022, and now 77-year-old Peter is currently residing in HMP Wakefield, which is nicknamed Monster Mansion for the dangerous people who have been incarcerated there. Allegedly, Peter would make good friends with notorious serial killer Harold Shipman during his time at HMP Wakefield. Sometime after 2015, police would be speaking to Peter Muir once again. In November 2015, two brothers who were camping in the Clerkenogh Woods where Ted Carthy was murdered would find a human skull almost completely concealed in moss and undergrowth. Police were notified and would go on to find the full skeleton of a man who they determined was murdered. It was also determined that this body had been laying there potentially since 1995 when Peter Muir was actively killing men. And I'm going to tell you all about the Clochanog Forest Man in next week's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in to this week's episode. If you enjoyed it, please make sure to leave me a nice review and to follow the podcast wherever you're listening. I would appreciate that so much. You can follow the podcast over on Instagram at TrueCrimeCaitlinPod, where I'll be posting images relating to this case and for any updates. Make sure you tune in again next week for a brand new episode.